Oh, yeah. Welcome back. This is Chris. No one should feel trapped. It's the same old grind, and it's a bore. I don't want to go no more. You want to do something new. I know you want to get out too. So here we go. Come along with me. When we first start out, sure not easy. But if you got a dream that you want to see, you've got to find a way to finally feel free. I'm not the type to give up. I won't ever be the last. I'm gonna start from scratch. I'm starting from scratch. And welcome back. This is a interview I have been like really excited to share with you guys. Some great advice that has made a big difference on my life. But I'm going to tell you the little quick story of how it came about. I interviewed in a past episode Kaylee Summit, who she keeps an exciting group going online, the International Entrepreneur Academy, and she posts like daily on there, giving challenges and ideas and ways for entrepreneurs to interact. And one of the challenges she posted was, reach out and contact your idol or hero. And I took her up on that offer that day. I wrote an email, you know, to Thomas M. Stirner, the author of The Practicing Mind, a book that I had just been listening to. And I'd listened to it two times because I liked it so much. And got going on it a third time now. And it's really affected my thinking. So I contacted Thomas M. Stirner, and sure enough, couldn't believe it. Next day, there's an email back from him. And it's not just a short email. It's, you know, a pretty in-depth email. And he answered my questions and gave me some suggestions. We emailed back and forth a few times, and he agreed to come on this podcast. What a guy, you know. And then just talking to him, he's very humble and just a really neat, down-to-earth guy. And he's got this awesome advice, and it's been helping me out, and I know it'll help you out too. So Thomas M. Stirner is a father, you know. He's got kids. He's a family man. He's the author of two books now. He's a best-selling author. His books are The Practicing Mind, and the newer one is called Fully Engaged. He's the founder, CEO of the Practicing Mind Institute. Before he became a self-published author and entrepreneur, he was working in his original business, which he started as an entrepreneur also, which was piano tuning and piano rebuilding, which he did for 25 years. And he worked for world-famous, world-class musicians and, you know, really high-profile folks. Super stressful job that he tells some stories about in this episode. But he's also a speaker, a coach. He speaks all over the place and very desirable. Now after I did the podcast with him, I looked up him up on like YouTube, and there's all these interviews. You know, I'm not nearly the first person to interview Tom, but and maybe that's why he did such an awesome job. he's had some practice at it. But what's truly amazing about what he presents is, it's kind of a different way of looking at life and your day-to-day dealings and optimizing your the flow of the way you do things and the way you think about doing things. And so I'll talk a little bit more about that aspect at the end of the podcast. So I'm going to get on to the interview. Thanks for coming and checking this out. I'm really excited about this one. Oh, and I had to do another shout. The intro song you heard in the beginning is a song that was created by my friend Dan, and he makes music like that. So if you're looking for some kind of musical tracks, contact me through the website. I'm startingfromscratch.com. And here's Thomas M. Stirner.
Well, I'm glad I'm glad that we connected, and I read your email this morning, and there's absolutely no reason to feel nervous. This is just two friends talking about interesting stuff.
Great. So, yeah.
That's the way I look
at it.
Well,
I guess it's just a tribute to your work, and that, you know, I'm so impressed by the things you've written that, you know, I really look up to you. So thanks a lot for,
Well, I look up to you, believe me. This is the part that I have a bit of a struggle with, is, the part where people, I don't want to say put me up on a pedestal, but it's kind of like the accolades. The accolades are really wonderful for me, because it's what I do is a lot of work, and there's a lot of time when nobody's noticing. I get emails all the time from people that are, that talk to me about, you know, your work has changed my life, and people contact me and they tell me things about themselves personally, and they've never met me. It's really quite an honor. But at the same time, you know, when I go places and, you know, people, the applause and everything, I don't know, it's kind of an uncomfortable thing to me. It's, feeling like I'm no different than anybody else. I've just read a lot. I'm very introspective and contemplative, and I've just tried to put out there what I've learned. But I don't look at myself as being any different than anybody else.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, though.
The fact that you're interested enough to talk to me is a big deal.
Cool.
To me.
Right on. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, though. Sometimes, like, you know, receiving compliments can actually be kind of difficult. So, yeah, I hear you.
It is. You're not really sure. Like I said, it's I mean, I've done things where I've had to, you know, obviously where I've gotten up in front of a lot of people, and it's just a strange feeling, you know, with the opening applause and everything. And I kind of feel like that, you know, that's nice. Let's get started and kind of push that away. But anyway, let's get started. You know, the 45 minutes an hour is
okay,
fine with
great.
Me.
So that actually, I hope you don't mind. I just started recording. I figured I could kind of edit out the whatever doesn't work later.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a radio show for over a year, a couple of years ago, called Living in the Present, and I was on your side of the microphone.
Oh, okay. I've
so
been there.
I know exactly
awesome.
What you're talking
okay.
about.
You know, that's funny. You kind of brought up a subject that I've been thinking about. Sometimes, like you were saying, when you receive compliments, or you get to the point where you've done something that's worthy of praise, but the hard work is already done to that point, you know, the journey has been each moment up leading up to when you reach some sort of success. And it's funny because you can't see a lot of times in that process of working hard on something, you know, the way it's going to turn out. And that's one thing that really impresses me about the practicing mind, the things you talk about in there.
Well, we work in plateaus and we don't realize it. You know, for example, I think I mentioned this in the practicing mind, that, you know, one time I was trying to, as a jazz pianist, I was trying to learn a specific riff, and the riff was just not working. I mean, I was practicing the arpeggiated scale runs, you know, every day, and I just didn't see anything happening. And I began to question whether I was maybe physically as a musician, I've hit my, you know, my limit, and I'm at my wall, and I'm just not going to get any better than this. And this riff is just not something I can play. And I basically quit doing it. And about 2 weeks later, I was on a gig, and I was taking a solo, and for some reason I decided to try to do the riff. It was a kind of a laid back gig, and there wasn't anybody there I knew, so I wasn't really worried about if I flubbed it. And it was there effortlessly, and it really took me back. And what I learned from it was that it takes, and I learned this really factually later as I studied how the brain works, but it takes the brain so long to make the synapses. It's a physical thing that has to happen. And if I had known that, and somebody had said, look, if you do this every day for 10 minutes in 2 weeks, that's how long it's going to take for your brain to figure out how to make this connection between your idea and your head and make it come out your fingers. you'll have it. And then the journey would have been so much more effortless because I wouldn't have been saying, well, why can't I do it? Why can't I do it? And I would have said, well, I shouldn't be able to do it yet because it's only been 4 days. You know, it takes 2 weeks for my brain to figure this out. I just have to keep feeding it in the pattern, and then it will convert that. And so my point is that, you know, there's all this stuff that's going on underneath the surface that we are not aware of, that when we work every day, whether it's doing a jazz riff or our business or, you know, as entrepreneurs, our business, we're putting this information in, we're putting this energy in, we're learning, we're gathering data. All this stuff is happening every day, and we can't really see it all the time because we're on this plateau and it looks like we're not moving forward. But then all of a sudden there's a point where we jump up, opportunities show up, people we've networked call us back, and all of a sudden now we're on this next level, but we didn't see that. And so we have to learn that is the cycle of moving forward, and if we can do that, we can relax.
What struck me while you were telling that story about the jazz piece, that it's really in a way kind of being patient with yourself, you know, because the internal mind's always trying to say, oh, it's not good enough, I'm not going to be able to do it. And you just have to feel like, calm down, self. It's going to take some time.
Yeah, it's being patient with yourself and the process. There's a chapter in Fully Engaged, the second book that was just released in October. And the name of the chapter is Creating Goals with Accurate Data. Because that's a big problem that we have. Many times as entrepreneurs, we don't know, and not just as entrepreneurs, but just in life in general, we don't know how long it should take to accomplish something. But we always seem to attach a time frame to it immediately after we set the goal. And then we begin to judge our progress in relationship to that time frame. So the example that I always give in these type of interviews, because it's so obvious to people, is someone saying, you know, I want to lose 20 pounds. That should take 10 days. Well, it's not that you just can't do it unless you're doing something that's very unhealthy. So when you set out, you've already created a goal that has inaccurate data, but you've set a time frame that's really based on nothing. It's just a feeling, a speculation, whatever. So now what happens? Well, now you begin to work towards this goal, and you may be doing everything right and actually moving forward very quickly, but you're not aware of it because you're constantly comparing where you are in that 10 days. So 4 days into it, you look on the scale and you've lost like, you know, 3 or 4 pounds, and you're like, this is not, you know, I'm a failure at this. This isn't going to work. This 10-day number is coming up at me, and I'm nowhere near my 20 pounds. And then you begin to second guess your ability to achieve goals in general and your confidence. And all these things begin to erode, even though you may be moving ahead very quickly. But it's all because you've set goals with inaccurate data. And I, you know, in the book, I tell a whole story about, you know, that's, you know, I've been there, done that. So I learned that lesson.
I can't wait to dig into Fully Engaged. That's my next book. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm curious, though, do you I'm kind of going through some struggles these days. I'm feeling like I'm sort of at one of those lower points, and I'm kind of trying to remind myself, like, this is the part where you're actually doing the hard work that's going to, you know, get to that point I'm trying to reach someday. But it's not really, I guess the goal is part of what screws you up in a way, you know, having that unrealistic expectation or a I'm curious, do you ever have a time in your life, a story you might be able to tell me about that, where you felt like you failed something?
Well, yeah, briefly, there's certainly been more than one, and until I actually learned about this choosing, understanding that I may not be able to have all the data, you know, even knowing, okay, well, I'm going to choose this goal, so let's make sure we have accurate data. Well, the fact is that you may not be able to have all the data when you start out on a goal because you don't have enough information and you don't have enough experience. You have to learn this in order to make this decision here, and you haven't gotten there yet. And I've learned all of those things, so I tend to relax, you know, more when I pick goals because I don't have these expectations. But you know, creating, publishing The Practicing Mind, I mean, I don't know if everybody knows that, but when I first wrote The Practicing Mind, it was self-published. I had a very successful service business that I had built over almost 30 years. I started it when I was 19, and it was when I was at the University of Delaware, and that was the piano technology business. And I just had a knack for it because I was a pretty good musician and was also very detail-oriented, and I was very mechanical. My mother was extremely detail-oriented, very quiet and disciplined. My father was very mechanical, very brilliant, actually, in that area. So I grew up with kind of like my mom's personality, but my being around my father all the time. I didn't have any brothers, so I spent a lot. My dad and I have always been best friends, so I spent a lot of time with him, and he was always showing me, okay, you see, this works here, this lever moves this, and then this arc has to happen. And so I was always around that. So as I got into the piano technology business, I was very successful at a very young age and pretty quickly. And the other thing I had going for me was that it was an octogenaric career. I mean, everybody that I met that was in the career, there were no young people. Yeah. Everybody was, was my father's age. And so what was happening was, as I was getting into it, they were retiring. And because they all knew me, they were just handing me their businesses. So there was no money exchange. People were just saying, I'm getting out of business. This is the guy you want to call. So I ended up having, within 3 or 4 years, I had a very big business. And that business was a success, and I wrote The Practicing Mind, during that time later on, and I tried to, it just sat as a Word document for like 10 years because I couldn't, that was around the mid-90s was when I wrote it, and I just kept trying to figure out how to publish it, I knew I had to have a cover design, all this stuff, and I didn't know where to go or what to do. And at that time, the internet was, also not what it is today. And you didn't have the options like Amazon publishing and all this other stuff that's out there now. So I knew I couldn't get a publisher because it was the old credit story. You couldn't get a publisher unless you had an agent. And you couldn't get an agent unless you had a published book. So it was like I decided, well, I'm going to have to self-publish this and figure it out. And it got to the point where I decided, well, the only way this is going to happen is to sell my business. I'm just going to have to walk away from this success, the service business that was really making me quite a bit of money, and just dive into this book thing. This is what I want to do in the second half of my life. And it was a really gutsy thing. I had my daughters were in high school. They were going to be in college in a couple of years, and I was walking away from this income and jumping off this cliff. And a lot of people thought I was, and it was really pretty stupid. But I had always seemed to be able to pick a goal and accomplish it. And so I figured I would figure it out. But the thing that I messed up on that really wasn't a mess up, it was I didn't have enough information. And I assumed initially, well, let me see. There's the internet. This is all, it seems like pretty logical. There's the internet. It's worldwide. So I write this book. I put a website out there. If I connect with 0.1% of the people that are on the internet, I'm really healthy financially. Well, so that was how I thought, and it didn't work that way. I mean, I got the book out there. I sold everything I had in the business. I had business properties full of tens of thousands of dollars of machinery. I sold all that stuff, put the money in the bank, and I was cash rich. And I sold the client base. I even signed a disclaimer saying that I would not go back into that business for at least 5 years, because the guy that bought the business knew if I went back into the business, he would lose all the customers.
Wow.
So, I burned my bridges.
Man.
There was nowhere to go except to make this thing work. And so initially it was, the nice thing about it was that in the piano service business, I was in such demand that I was always working 7 days a week and 65, 70 hours a week. And I just couldn't get time off. And because it was an artisan job and people wanted me specifically to do the work. So all of a sudden I had this lifestyle where, I went from getting up at 5:30 in the morning, sometimes going out and doing a concert setup and then coming back and getting my girls' lunches made and clothes ironed for school or whatever I had to do and getting them to school and then going back out on the road and then coming home and making dinner and then going back into my shop and working until 10:30 at night. I mean, it was a crazy, difficult, strenuous lifestyle. And now here I was getting up in the morning and I could take a walk, and I was producing the audio version. I have a recording studio in my house. So I was like, I'm sitting there drinking a cup of coffee, working on this recording. I'm like, man, this is five-star living. But things didn't, you know, initially when I got the book out there, I was paying all the bills I had paid before when I was bringing in all this income. And I was also had hemorrhaging money, putting money into the book and, you know, having it printed and all those types of expenses, thousands of dollars. And I had no, I was completely unemployed. And so I assumed I had enough money to cover that. And, you know, I put the book out there, finally got it. And it was so exciting. The big truck comes to the house and we're unloading all these boxes of books. And I'm like, you know, wow, there it is. My name on the book. This is the coolest thing. And I get the website up, and of course, the website's not working correctly. It's taking too long to get it up, and all the things that you deal with, especially back in the 10, 15 sure. years ago. And then the book's on Amazon and my website, and I'm selling two or three books a week. Nobody knows who I am. Nobody knows what The Practicing Mind is about. It does. It has no track record, no traction, and I'm watching my money go away. Man. And so, you know, that was definitely a situation where I thought, you know, I made a bad
move. What have I done?
but the thing, you know, what's interesting, Chris, was I just kept going back to what I had written about in the book, you know, about using the goal as a rudder, staying in the process, and just, you know, my mind always wanted to go into panic mode, but I just knew that there was, that had nothing to do with solving the situation. It was, and you know, part of that was, you know, you learn that as a pilot. I mean, I have a pilot's license, and you know, when the engine quits, I've always said you can scream all the way to the ground, or you can look at the situation, analyze it, don't judge it, but just analyze it and go, what are my options? What can I do? And so I, you know, that training between that becoming an integrated part of my personality just through practice and everything I had learned in what I wrote about, and then in my studies in aviation and those sort of things, that was what I did. I just kept pulling my mind back because I knew that getting upset and giving in to feelings of panic and all those things were not going to fix the situation. They had nothing to do with fixing the situation. And I just kept plugging away, and well, I guess the rest is history. Eventually, the book took off, and then it became number one in stress management and several times on Amazon. And then I got during that time, I tried to get an agent, and they said, you're not big enough yet. But in about 6 months, you'll start getting phone calls from agents. And that's exactly what happened. I got called by an agent, and she said, I read your book. It looks like it's self-published. I said, it is. She said, that means, you know, you own the rights. I said, yeah. She said, well, I think I can get you a pretty big contract. And away we went.
Wow.
But that time period was, let me think, that time period was probably about 6 years of, you know, me having ups and downs and struggles and all those sort of things.
That is a good story. That's hitting me right, you know, right where, you know, because where I'm trying to kind of reach is people who are trying to start out their own thing. You know, I was in a job that I didn't like, and I decided, you know, I'm going to quit this and go on my own. And it's been a struggle, you know, as I look out there for information to help people out in this situation, you know, what if you're in a career and you want to start your own business or do something that's more meaningful to you? How do you make that transition? It's not easy. You know, you're going to face, like you said, this time where there, you don't know what you're up against to, you know, change your life, you know, to move into something new. And that story you told is just, it totally is right up the alley of what I'm talking about. And I guess my point is, I feel like that part is kind of the hardest part of anything. Would you agree, you know, that starting out part?
Absolutely, I do. I think that there's, you know, there are many people have skills that they have learned in the corporate world that are very useful to starting a business, but there are skills in being an entrepreneur that they are unaware of and that they can't develop until they're in that situation. And, you know, learning when you start out as an entrepreneur, the scenario that's very common is too much work for one person, not enough income for more than one. And so you end up wearing a lot of hats. And as you start out, it's very easy for the initial enthusiasm that brought you to that point to start to burn off, because you don't see success immediately. Now, I did have a little bit of an advantage because when I started the piano business, of course, I was 19. I was still living at home. I didn't need to make a lot of money. But if you're in a situation where when I started this business, becoming a writer and a coach and all those sort of things, then that was a completely different position. I had, like I said, I had kids that were going to be going into college. I had mortgage payments, had all this sort of stuff, and I just couldn't survive with no income for an extended period of time. And you get into the other thing that the people that get into launch an entrepreneurship career is, it's very easy to get to that point where you go, you know what, I can't sustain this, but I've put so much into it, I don't want to walk away, because maybe tomorrow, next week, next month is when everything's going to turn around. And if I leave now, I'll never know that. If I go back into the corporate world, or if I go back and, working for a job. But this whole thing of leaving the corporate world and becoming an entrepreneur is a global phenomenon. Believe me, I work with people I'm involved with people that are trying to help people in this situation on a global scale, because the corporate environment is so toxic, with this, companies buying up another company and then firing a bunch of people and then giving the remaining people their jobs. So now, this person they get rid of three people and give those people's jobs to this person, but that person still has their own job. So now, the mental, the stamina that it takes and the emotional stamina it takes to deal in that situation is terrible. Plus the people aren't making any more money. So it's a very toxic situation. And it's driving people. They're saying, you know what, if I'm going to put this kind of time in, this kind of hours and this much life energy, it may as well be for myself. So I'm going to go off and be an entrepreneur. But there are skill sets. And I think that's not to pitch my coaching personally, but that's where coaching is, I think, one of the best investments you can make in yourself when you start on that road, because you get somebody else's perspective, somebody that has been there. It's like a mentorship, and the person does several things. They say, look, instead of feeling like you're so dispersed mentally, which is what happens when you become an entrepreneur, you're trying to wear so many hats, that person can help you to focus on specific things, the 4S words, as I wrote about in The Practicing Mind. And also they can motivate you, and they can keep you realistic, like the types of things that I was just talking about, where you're setting these goals and the goals are unrealistic and you're actually moving ahead very quickly, but you don't know that you're moving ahead quickly, and you also don't notice the wake behind the boat. And that's what the coach is good at doing. And I've seen this with people, and you turn their experience of their day, what it feels like to be in their head for the day, completely changes. They go from this state of mind of being very agitated and stressed to feeling very content and very processed in the moment, and they become much more productive. There's a story I used to tell a lot that kind of demonstrates this. I had a woman that left the corporate world, and she wanted to be in visual arts. And so she began studying visual arts. And when she contacted me in the first conversation we had, and I've told this story many times, but she said, I said, so what are you struggling with? That was kind of how we started out. And she said, well, I've been in this new career effort for 6 months, and I'm not as good as I should be. And so to me, the common sense question was, well, how good should you be? Because I'm thinking she's measuring herself, and there's this silence on the other side of the phone. And she said, I don't really know. And I said, well, if you don't know how good you should be, how do you know you're not better than you should be for somebody who's been in it for 6 months? And she said, I never thought of it like that. And I said, well, if you look at what your skill level is now and what you can accomplish, if someone could have touched you on the head with a wand 6 months ago when you started, and you were able to do that then, would you have felt that you were good? And she said, oh, yeah, absolutely I would. I said, so it's not that you're not moving forward and that you're not getting better. It's that your perception of how good you can be is always changing as you grow. And she said, yeah, I guess that's it. I said, no, wasn't that always going to be the case? I mean, it's that's you learn that in music, you know, studying music. You know, when you start out, you're just trying to figure out where the note on the page is on the instrument, you know, and how to make your fingers do this or that. As you move forward, you really can't comprehend what it would be like to play a Chopin Nocturne in D flat. I mean, you're just trying to, you're here, and that's the threshold of what your ability to perceive is playing. But as you move forward, you begin to see people that are way better than you, and you really have an idea of what they've accomplished. You can look, when you're just starting out, you can look at a classical player and you can say, yeah, they're really good, but you really don't understand how good they are, what it takes to do what they're doing. It just, because they make it look easy because they've been doing it for so long. So it's really important that I think is to have somebody who's kind of watching you, who can say, yeah, but look at what you're doing now. Look at the way you just processed this situation, and look at how you processed it 3 weeks ago when we first started talking. Do you see the difference? And that's when people realize, like I said, because they're living through it in real time, they don't notice the change. But I think it's very important for people when they get into a new career, because it's a very stressful time, and I think it's one of the best investments they can make.
That's great advice. One thing that's helped me out a lot is having people that I talk to on a regular basis. I meet with weekly, and you know, just recently I kind of was able to look back at the last few months. We kind of did like a, you know, end of the year, you know, looking at the goals I set last year and how am I doing? And it was like, wow, you know, I really did a lot of stuff that I haven't done before and accomplished quite a bit. You know, it was amazing when you look back at it. And I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense to have, you know, some of that. I mean, the hardest part, like we talked about, is all these unknowns and lack of information. So if you have someone that has some of that information, then it can kind of fill in that gap. That's
well, it's also very easy when you begin as an entrepreneur to feel very isolated. You know, and you are isolated. You know, I did a talk one time in Philadelphia. It was all technical people. I think a lot of IT people were there, and this guy had read The Practicing Mind, and he had a think tank, and so he had a very generous service that he offered. Every month he rented this room in this big corporate building, and he bought pizza and beer, and anybody could show up for this thing. And what he would do is he usually tried to get one speaker who was kind of like a keynote speaker, and then he had numerous people he would give, people could sign up for it, that were there as part of the audience, but they could get up and basically showcase what their work was so that they might pick up, you know, work. And there was usually between 200 and 300 people at this thing. And we had had lunch, and he had asked me if I would come and do this talk. And he really didn't have any idea how this was going to land, talking about present moment functioning and all this sort of stuff in this group, because most of these people, the people that he would have, were talking about, you know, how do you upload your videos faster, you know, to your site to market your services or whatever. And I only had, because of the time constraints, because he had to allow other people to get up and hawk their wares, which I wasn't doing. I was just talking about how to practice your being an entrepreneur. And so I only had like 10 to 15 minutes. So, you know, normally I would talk for several hours. So I made that point in the beginning. I said that I was really just going to be able to just hit on one or two things, because I didn't want to try to jump around and give them a little bit of information on a whole lot of different subjects. But what the phenomena was, and the point of me bringing this up, is that he had to stop the Q&A because it would have gone on for several hours. And what happened with the people was they said, this is the first time as an entrepreneur I feel so isolated, and I feel like no one understands what I'm going through, and I don't know how to deal with these feelings I'm having every day. This is the first time somebody's actually addressed that. And my point is that this is what happens when people, they neglect that area when they get into entrepreneurship. They're always trying to figure out, how do I move more merchandise? How do I move more services? How do I promote my business? But when that's happening, it requires the ability to stay in the process and to know the goal, but not judge your progress as you're moving towards the goal, because all of those things impede your productivity, and they also impact your experience of growing as an entrepreneur. And that's the thing that is never really, really covered. And I think that that's why what we're talking about is so important, is when you do become an entrepreneur, it's a very exciting time, but it's very easy as an individual to feel isolated. Many times you don't have the income and the cash flow or the investors to hire a whole bunch of people to be a team. You have to start somewhere, and you're usually living off of, you know, money from your 401 or something like that. And, you know, and that takes, it's so helpful to have what you just described, where you meet with some other people, you have like a support system, so you can feel like you're not so isolated.
Yeah, it's scary. And I'm kind of one of those people that's a little reckless in kind of the way I'm going about things and learning. You know, I tend to learn things that way. You know, I tend to just get into something and, you know, fall down, get my bumps and bruises, and get up and keep going. But I've noticed a lot of people are wiser than I am, and they take a more careful route. And I think I would recommend that to anyone who's, you know, given what I've learned, you know, in the process of trying to make a change like this, is find a good coach, like someone like Tom, find some good advice. Because like I'm studying, you look on the internet and there's all these like, here's how you get rich, here's how you make money, here's how, like you said, here's how you promote yourself. And it's always all these details and the end result, but not a lot of explanation or you know, kind of letting you know what you're in for, which is the beginning part, which is anxiety and fear and all these unknowns. And you just hit the nail on the head the way you answered that question. I guess that is I'm curious. It seems like you're pretty self-motivated when you made that decision, and I love that story about how when you basically took a huge leap of faith, leaving your piano business. What, in writing your book and doing all this on your own, what inspired you or motivated you? Are you just a self-motivated person, or were there some particular books or things in your life or people that really kind of urged you forward on these big moves you made?
Well, I realized there was a couple things. I mean, one was I realized from a business model, what was wrong with the piano technology business was that it was what I'll say is a work for a dollar, make a dollar job. And that's not all bad. I mean, you know, someone said, I would say, okay, I have a grand piano. The felt hammers are worn off on it, and I want you to replace them. Well, you know, you're talking about on a piano that's worth $70,000, it might cost them $2,500 to replace the hammers on it. There's quite a bit of work in it, a lot of measuring. Everything you do on a piano is extremely repetitive because there's 88 notes. And also there's the adjustments are all, you know, many of the adjustments you're dealing with are in 32nds of an inch and 16ths of an inch. So it's quite a bit of work. So there you go. They go, all right, well, can you replace this? Because obviously the piano is worth it. So you do that job. It takes you so many hours. You hand them the keyboard back with the new hammers. They hand you a check. Done deal. It's a closure. The end of the day, you go home, or it's the weekend and work's done. You can go do whatever you want. But what's wrong with that is that you end up, you have to be physically working in order to be making money. And the other problem with that is you can never make more money than you can physically do in a day, and especially in a job like that, because I saw that very early on. I didn't have anybody in my family that was a business person. So I was basically learning this as I went. My parents thought the fact that I was working 70 hours a week was, you know, it was a good thing. Like, I'm telling you, he is just so successful, he can't take a day off, you know. Well, that's not success as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, for them, it was like, that's how good he is. That's how much people want him to do their work. Yeah. You know, he's turning work away. He's got 3 years of work booked in his rebuilding shop. Yeah, but I can't take a day off and I'm exhausted. So I saw that I did not want to spend the second half of my life that way, and that I wanted a job that was paying me when I was, you know, taking a ride in an airplane or playing around the golf or spending time with my daughters, you know. So I knew that I wasn't going to be able to do that maybe all the time, and it wasn't going to be like that initially, but I had to come up with something. So I saw that was one of the things that I saw that made me feel like I need to go in a different direction. The book thing with the growth of the internet, I could see down the road. I could also see that, you know, well, if I have with the problem with the piano, just if you just look at the tuning portion of it, it's like how many piano tunings can you do in a year? And let's just say it's 1,000. And let's just say in order for you to maintain 1,000 tunings a year, that's your maximum number that you can do. You need 2,000 clients because everybody doesn't tune their piano. Some people that tune it every 2 years, some people every 6 months. It just depends on how the instrument's being used. But let's just say you need 2,000 people to give you a maximum capacity of tuning schedule. Well, what happens once you pass 2,000? Well, that's what happened to me. Now you got 3,000 customers. You can't make any more money because you can't do any more tunings in a day. Then you got 4,000 customers. Then you got 5,000 customers. You're not making any more money. Now it's just pressure because you got all these people saying, yeah, but we're having a wedding and the reception's at the house and we really need it this weekend. And you're like, there's no place to put you. I'm working as many hours as I can. And it just becomes a stress thing. And I thought, this is a really bad business model and I need to change that. So I saw that in the book when I wrote The Practicing Mind, and then it was printed. It was like if Amazon said, we need another 400 books, I didn't have to sit there and physically write 400 books. I just sent them a couple boxes. I thought, yeah, this is five-star living again. This is what I wanted. But at the same time, if you're not selling books, you're not making money. So I would say that was one of the things that motivated me. On a more personal level, I wanted to spend – the reason I was so successful in the service business is because I love interacting with people. I always got in some of the most wonderful conversations with people. Many of my customers became my friends. They were intensely loyal, and I felt like I enjoyed counseling them, coaching them about their piano needs and their musician. As a musician, I enjoyed coaching them because I was working with the best musicians in the world in my concert schedule. I mean, the best classical musicians, the best jazz musicians, pop, country. I met so many of those people, sat in their dressing rooms, sat in their trailers. Because of that, I had a lot of information that I could pass on to people many times about specific artists that were their inspiration that I had, you know, the opportunity to talk to. So I really enjoyed that aspect of interacting with people and having conversations. Plus, every day I had to knock on somebody's door that I didn't know, and I had to create a trust factor that was strong enough that they would call me back for the next time. And I found that I really enjoyed that. So I realized that what I wanted to do in the second half was I wanted to connect with large, large numbers of people, as many as I could, and I wanted to make an impact on their life. And so that was what I came up with, was writing about what I had learned, writing about, and initially The Practicing Mind was, I had envisioned it to be a book for musicians because I saw so many people in my business that were adults. And they had been in the corporate world, and they had the house, they had the car, they had all this stuff. And they were looking, they still were unfulfilled, and they were looking for something that was more internal, something that was more personal, and something that they feel more personally connected to, and that was more spiritual, if you will. And so they would buy a nice piano, and they'd start taking piano lessons, and 6 months later, they weren't practicing, and they were ending up quitting. And I thought, you know, I've been there, done that. I know where that comes from, where that feeling comes from, and I think I can turn it around for people. So that was initially how the concept and idea for The Practicing Mind came about. But then as I began writing the book, I saw that, you know, I approach everything this way, and I need to change this so that it can connect with more people. And so that, again, was the reason why I really left that business and decided this is what I want to do. I wanted to spend the second half impacting people. And that has been the total joy in the whole experience. And there has been times when, like I said, it's been very difficult. There was a phrase I heard one time with a country western singer that had really struggled, and eventually he made it big. And somebody asked him, or somebody said, it must be really nice to have all this success. And the guy said, yeah, it was a 10-year overnight success. And that's how this is felt. I mean, what people see is, oh, you're a best-selling author, and you're people want you to talk and all these interviews and everything. But I have, it has been a one step at a time. It's been over 10 years since I've been doing this. It wasn't like this, for the first couple of years. It was a pretty fearful, and could be fearful, and could be very much a sense of struggle. And and for me, it's even worse because, when you write a book like The Practicing Mind, everybody expects you to walk the talk.
Yeah.
And they expect you you know how to do all this stuff. And I remember I studied a meditation class with someone who was certified through Deepak Chopra. And she was telling me, he struggles with walking the talk with what he's doing. It's, just because you know how something, what works, it doesn't mean it's always easy to do it. There's a tremendous pull to go in other directions, in large part because our whole culture and the media has a connection to us all the time, and they're constantly pushing this instant gratification, and you're incomplete, and you need this over here. So every day we're getting this stuff pumped into us on the television, on our smartphones, on our iPads, on the radio. It's because it's all part of selling us stuff and making us feel like, well, the reason life is passing me by, I don't have this and I need that. And so we're always in this state of feeling like I'm incomplete, and and that doesn't go away just because you become an entrepreneur. And as you stated earlier, you leave this corporate job and you start this entrepreneur job, and you're like, why am I not, some multi-million dollar .com company all of a sudden? It appears that happens, but most of the time when you start going behind the curtain, you find out now there's a lot of hardship that was there. But that's really what motivated me, and that's what continues to motivate me.
Wow, that's you actually answered kind of two of my questions in one too, because I think the other part that I really I know we're kind of getting close to the end of the time here, but the other thing that really impresses me about what you do is that it has so much meaning to you and to other people, and that's important to me too. I think choosing a new path, being self-aware, it seems like, is one of the keys that got you there. And then choosing a new path that has some sort of deeper meaning or purpose to you seems to me pretty key, to being successful and feeling happy in your day-to-day life.
I think that you're absolutely right, Chris. I think that what pushes people in that direction is, they end up, they dread going to work. They can't wait to get done. It's always on their mind. And at some point they begin to ask themselves, I'm never happy. Is this all there is? There has to be more. There has to be more I can do. There has to be something. I have abilities. I don't even know what they are, but I have abilities. And we see so many times these people go to college and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars for a degree, and 3 years after they're out, they're doing something completely unrelated because they don't. I mean, I've known people like that. I have a colleague that came out of college, top of her class, ended up. This is in Delaware. She had immediately ended up with a job at one of the most prestigious accounting firms in New York. And she said 3 months into the job up there, she was like, why in the world did I ever decide I wanted to do this? She like, can't stand it. And eventually she took a job running the financial department of a corporation back in Delaware. She said, at least I was dealing with investments there and not these just accounting numbers. And then she left that and became a coach. Because she said she was just so unfulfilled, and she's had her struggles, as becoming an entrepreneur. But I think that this is what we're seeing in the world today, as again, because the corporations are so geared towards profit that they're driving, they're just driving people into the ground and using them up, and then just replacing them. And there's in the introduction to Fully Engaged, there is the story I told about a number of years ago. I was asked by an investment firm in New York to come up and do a working lunch. So, I mean, I've only been up to New York a handful of times, and it's like a 2-hour ride on the train. So I get on the train in Wilmington first thing in the morning, and I walk through like 5 cars, and there's no seats. And I end up, the one seat there is that this is a synchronistic story, is what I'm leading up to. There's one seat next to this business guy. So I sit in that seat. He's sitting there working away. He's obviously, the train runs from D.C., Washington, D.C., up to Boston. And it stops in Wilmington, Philadelphia, I think Newark, Penn Station, and then it goes on to Boston. So anyway, he's working away. He's been working away since he got on the train in D.C., and I'm just sitting there. I'm going through my briefcase looking at stuff I'm going to talk about, and we don't say a word to each other. And so we're 15 minutes out of Penn Station, and the guy comes on and says, we'll be entering Penn Station in 15 minutes, and he closes his laptop, and then he just, introduces himself and just says, do you go to New York often? And I said, no, actually I don't. I said, I've only been a couple of times. I said, how about you? And he said, yeah. I work out of a company in Virginia, but we have a satellite division in New York. And he said, I come up here once a month for a meeting. So he said, so I'm curious. He said, what's bringing you to New York today? And I said, well, I wrote this book, and this company wants me to do a working lunch. He said, that sounds cool. What's the name of the book? And I said, well, I have a copy here. I started pulling the Practicing Mind out of my briefcase, and he grabs it and says, you're not Tom Stirner, are you? Well, I'm like floored, because I can't believe this guy's heard of me. And I said, yeah. And he goes, I cannot believe I have been sitting on a train next to you for 2 hours. He said, this book is part of the reason I'm coming to New York today. Wow. And I said, well, I'm not following you. And he said, and this is the juice of the story. He said, our company has realized that we just can't squeeze any more blood out of a stone. He said, the way that we're managing our employees is creating so much stress on them. Then they're going home with this stress, creating stress at home, which is the adding on, and then they're bringing that back to work the next day. And it's this downward spiral that's destroying the company. And he said, so we have realized that we need a new model, and we're trying to figure out what the best model is and how to construct it. And The Practicing Mind is one of the books that we're using. And he said, so I could have been picking your brain for 2 hours. But the point is there that this is the environment, and it is changing. It's very hopeful. It is changing, and the reason it's changing, people say, like, what's it going to take to make a change in the corporate environment? What it will take is for one or two corporations to begin to adopt this present moment functioning as a way of increasing productivity and performance, and at the same time bringing a sense of calmness within the company. And when that happens, the other corporations won't be able to compete. It's very similar to how it was in sports psychology. When this stuff first started entering sports psychology, everything was focused on the physicality of sports. And once they got the athletes to the point where they couldn't really eke much performance out of them physically, that left the mind. If a guy has a perfect golf swing and you can videotape it and put sensors on him and he can swing and you can see, you're transferring the maximum energy into the ball and you have the most control. Well, why can't he do it all the time? Well, why can't he win every week? And so the whole thing is because the mind is what's in control of everything else. So then they started looking at that. And initially, before Jack Nicklaus, nobody was doing this stuff. Then Jack Nicklaus comes along and he's just naturally, the way he works mentally and physically, he's visualizing the shot and actually kind of like he used to describe it as like watching a video. He said, I would like roll the tape backwards. He said, I would stand behind the ball and I would see the shot unfold in my head and then I would roll it backwards and bring the ball back to me. And he's just way ahead of his time doing this stuff. And what happens? He becomes the best golfer in history. And he's very difficult to compete against. And now nobody is competitive in sports without using this stuff. They just simply can't compete unless they integrate this whole mindfulness and present moment functioning and meditation and all these things. They have to do it in order to be able to compete. And that's where I see the corporations going. Right now, I still get the people that contact me, somebody who I've worked with or I've met, and they'll contact me and they'll say, I've read The Practicing Mind, you've been such a big help, I've talked to my boss, he wants to know what you would cost to come talk here. And then I set up a phone call with the guy who owns the company. And his attitude, it's not always, but sometimes his attitude is, what are you going to say in 3 hours that are going to increase sales the next week? See, when you're in that mindset, you know, see, you're so attached to the goal that it's not going to work. That's like somebody going to a piano lesson and saying, what are you going to teach me today that's going to make me able to play like that guy over there? Like, you can't do it. Yeah, and that's a wrong attitude. And right now they can have that attitude because the attitude is to squeeze the people, make them afraid to lose their job, make them feel like they're lucky they have a job, and give them more work and just keep pushing them that way. Well, that whole paradigm is ending because you're starting to see this stuff come in. And just like in sports, it's going to be you can either adopt this mindset. It's been proven out and documented over and over again in studies that when we are in the present moment, we are functioning at our highest level with the least amount of effort. We accomplish things in the least amount of time, and our experience of accomplishing them is one of contentment and peace and no anxiety. And you can either adopt that, you know, or you can say, no, we're not busting. We're staying with the paradigm we have, but you're just going to start to see these people falling by the wayside. And then it will become more and more the norm because you'll have to be functioning in that in order to be competitive. And that's going to be good for the whole world.
I love that. You know, you reminded me one of my favorite, I'm a person who, I love quotes. One of my favorite quotes is Buckminster Fuller says, you never change things by fighting the existing reality. To change something, build a new model that makes the existing model obsolete. And that's kind of what you're describing is this, you know, this change where you're discussing is.
Well, we know this, as I said, from there's enough data out there and enough studies out there that we know that, you know, you and I are having this conversation, Chris. I mean, 10 years ago, we wouldn't have been. I mean, that's proof right there. You can talk about meditation and stuff like that, and you've got corporations that have meditation rooms or, you know, whatever you want to call it, whatever they call them. But again, you go back 20 years ago, 25 years ago, you know, the only people that meditated were, quote, hippies and guys over in India. You know, I mean, now it's really a very common thing, and because we're beginning. What motivates these people is what does it do to the bottom line? If it increases the bottom line, I'm all in. I don't care what the stuff is. So that's what motivates them. And that's why, you know, I told the story in the Practicing Mind about the Olympic archery coach, you know, like when they just could not back in the 70s, when this stuff was all kind of being developed, in the Asian mindset, it was just how you did things. And the Americans just were so attached to getting bullseyes versus the Asians, which were attached to the process of drawing the bow and letting the arrow go. And they're very diametrically opposed. But the Asians, they just couldn't beat them. The target just kept getting in the bullseye, just kept getting in the way of the Asian's arrow. And the Americans it was like the only reason they drew the bow was to let the arrow go and see if they got a bullseye. And then they immediately began this judging process. If the arrow missed the bullseye, oh, geez, I only got 3 shots. I'm already one down. And then this internal dialogue would start to ramp and all this stuff would come into it and degrade their performance. And, you know, now, and it's so prevalent in archery. I mean, you wouldn't even consider competing without this stuff. And here's a funny story. I got contacted by a Japanese company. The Practicing Mind is in Japanese now. And back when they contacted me, they wanted to publish it in Japanese. What they told me, I just thought that was amusing, was that this, what you talk about here, is a mindset that our culture was founded on. And we've gotten away from it because we've become so westernized. Yeah. And we want to get back to it. But in order to get back to it, we have to hear it from a Western perspective because we don't get the Eastern perspective
full circle
anymore. I just thought that was so crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. That's there's so much. My mind's just, you know, it's the same thing when I listen to you talk in the book, that my mind's so full of ideas. And you know, I could just go on talking to you for forever, it feels like, but I know, you know, your time's super valuable, and we're getting towards the end of our time here for the episode, but thanks so much. I really appreciate you taking this time for me, and I think this will conversation will be valuable to a lot of other folks who I share it with too. And so,
I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so. This is part of the fun to me. You know, initially you're trying to get somebody to listen to what you say. You know, when you get to that point where people want to hear what you have to say, and then people are grateful when they're listening. Nothing beats impacting people's lives in a positive way. I mean, when you take somebody and you can alleviate suffering, however that suffering is, whether it's a physical kind of suffering or whether it's a mental anguish and anxiety, whatever that kind of suffering is, if you can alleviate that and you can see that in the person, it's just an incredible feeling. And so I'm always grateful for the opportunity to talk to people, whether it's through an interview like this or one-on-one. It really is wonderful.
Well, thanks so much. You've made a big difference in my life, and I probably will go on listening to you talk for the next few days. I'm going to download the new book, Fully Engaged. I can't wait to get going on that. It's awesome.
Very good.
All right. So I was just, you know, I've been listening to this episode myself quite a few times. When I go through the editing process, I always listen to the podcast, you know, at least a couple times. And I'm figuring out it's actually a lot better to go back and listen to the episode before I create the intro and the conclusion or the outro, because I think of more things in the weeks after. But I think what I really wanted to just kind of give you as a going away present is two of Thomas's main points that I think have really been helping me out in life. And one of them is basically just looking at life in more of a process versus product mindset, and it's more about each step than it is about the particular goal or where you're headed to. There's no end point, you know. The only end point in life is when you die, so it's really about every moment until then. So and then the four S's: short, small, simple, and slow. I had a weird moment not too long ago where I had to clean the bathrooms, and I was a little not in the best mood that night. And it was reminded of the four S's, and I kind of did Tom's thing of just really slowing down, and I made myself move really slowly and just do one thing at a time. Like, you know, I'm just cleaning this area of the shower right now. I'm just going to concentrate on that and just try to put my mind in it, you know. And it was amazing how quickly it went by and how much more I enjoyed it than I normally would. And so I recommend working on that. Just try slowing down and working on the process. And I think you're going to find that whatever your endeavor is that you're working on, if you apply this to it and anything in your life, you're going to see some improvement. And that's going to help you get to where you want to be and move forward on your business goals or your entrepreneur plans. And that's about all I got to say on that. So I hope you're having a great week. I hope this episode helps you as much as it has me. And big thanks to Tom and my man Dan for making this outro music you're about to hear right here. And I'll see you guys in about 2 weeks. All right, later on.